correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com.
Welcome to Me and Steve Talk RPGs, a podcast where me and my friend Steve try and help you get the most out of your role-playing game experience. Hey folks, what's up? Welcome back to Me and Steve Talk RPGs. We've only got one Steve this week, at least for the moment. We may have another one later, but we'll see how that goes. But we've got a show, and we're going to talk some RPGs, have a special guest this week. But before I get to that, let me take a minute to talk to you about another podcast here on the D20 Radio Network, that being this week, the Genesis Archive, which is an actual play podcast featuring the Genesis RPG system. And I believe most of what they released to this point has been in their own setting, which they call the Unseen World, which is a modern urban fantasy set in Las Vegas. So you have vampires and werewolves and demons and all that kind of cool stuff. And the GM has done a lot of work to relate a lot of it to like folklore and whatnot as far as how the different, you know, things are set up. And of course, it all happens in Las Vegas, which also happens to be where he grew up. So he actually knows Vegas. And like I've said, talking about CSI, the TV show, you set it in Vegas, any storyline is possible. So like I said, very good show, very good role play. So check them out. There'll be a link to their feed in the show notes so you can find them easier. Or if you just search the Genesis Archive, it should come up. So that being that, this week I'm joined by someone you've actually heard on the show before. A few months back, he came to talk about a game that he was the creator for, that being Army Men, which successfully kickstarted and filled and shipped, and I have my copy, and it is very, very cool. So welcome back to the show, the literary mercenary, the one and only Neil Litherland.
Hey there, everybody. Glad to be back.
Yeah, nice to have you back. And I will say, not that, you know, when we talked about the game when you had it on before, I was really excited about it, but it was everything I expected when I actually got it. And you're already hard at work for supplements for it, spitting out ideas on many blogs about other things to do with it, one of which that rather intrigued me was, here, use your 40K figures, which I'm sure you have to be careful how you phrase that so GW doesn't, you know, get testy. But like, look, you already bought them. Why can't you play with them how you
absolutely
want?
Yeah, especially all the new Helldivers fans out there. Now you can play the home game.
So, and I did not realize this when we had you on initially. You do a lot of work in the RPG space, writing blogs, supplements, lots and lots of things. So would you care to expound a little on that? We didn't really get into that a lot the last time you were here.
That's fair. You know, there was a main item on the work table, and there wasn't a lot of time for all the other stuff. But for folks who don't recognize my name, I think at this point I've got between 170 and 180 supplements with my name in the credits. I'm aiming to have 200 by the end of the year, but we'll see how things go. I've done stuff for half a dozen different systems, half a dozen different settings, thanks to all the companies out there who have community use platforms. They've made my life so much better. And just generally speaking, part of it is because I have that same urge that I think all of us have at some point as TTRPG like players of, we'll see something or we'll read a thing and we'll be like, ooh, this is really cool. And then we'll have an idea and we'll be like, oh no, that idea is not canon. And I just stopped and went, wait a minute, I know the people who work on these games. I could make this canon. As partially just because I knew that I could write up a thing and give it to my DM or my storyteller or whoever. And there was like a 40-60 chance they'd let me do it. But if I showed up with an official book or publication, just boom, I would like this, please. As just a power move of just going a little too far. But yeah, it was one of those of, I spent so much of my day thinking about them anyway. I was like, well, I might as well just make this my job. And due to various lucky breaks and happenstance and meetings at cons, I got enough people who knew me who just allowed me to do that.
Well, that's cool. And I, you know, It's the one thing I like about a lot of the more indie side of the RPG space is the amount of passion that goes into the creation.
Yeah, absolutely.
People are making the stuff they want to play and then publishing it so other people can enjoy it too, which I think is markedly different from certain companies who are looking at it from the boardroom perspective of what can we sell enough profitable copies of.
Yeah, so what can we re-release and call it a remastering and get all of the copies sold again?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember Chris Spivey said, you know, when we had him on the one time, something about someone once told him the best way to make $1 million in the RPG industry was to start with two.
He's not wrong.
And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with any of his work, but it is very much passion projects and stuff that...
I have come across interviews with him. He seems pretty nice as far as I can tell.
Oh yeah, he's very, very passionate. And most of his stuff is very historic in some form or other, you know, specific parts of history, you know, like I have a copy of Harlem Unbound, Haunted West. Ooh. And it's a tome.
Yeah, it takes a whole nother kind of passion to get those details right. I have done very little in the way of historical RPGs, but the few that I have done required so much additional just lead up and just research and whatnot. It was fun and I liked it and I was glad for the opportunity, but when I was done, I was like, I need to do something with elves and dwarves. I want to make stuff up now.
Well, but there's a weight that comes with trying to do something historical because, like you said, you want to get it right. But the other thing that I've noticed with, and you've been posting on our Discord, a bunch of links to various projects, blog articles, whatever, and to the point that you actually inspired an episode a couple weeks ago because you wrote about scale, and I went, oh my God, I've thought about so much of this, but I never knew how to quantify it.
I was very pleased with that. I was very touched when I heard that episode of it was... I occasionally had moments where I had to remind myself, you're not on the episode. They're just mentioning your name. Don't talk into the mic because my mic's always right here next to my desk.
You're not the first person I've had tell me that about our show that like they'll occasionally like talk to their headphones. But I like the fact that some of your work at least seems to be here's some stuff to think about, not here's how to do it. Here's stuff to think about to make how you do it work better.
Absolutely. It is when I started Improved Initiative, like at least part of it was just because it was during like I won't say the heyday, but like the time where Pathfinder had become like the new industry standard. Like 4th edition had gotten its legs kicked out from under it. Nobody wanted any of that. 5th edition hadn't come out yet. So we were still in that very crunchy wilderness. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my main jam was being the person who would read the 35 separate rule books and lead people through the wilderness of here's all your options, here's what I recommend, but do with it as you please. And then as the push for simpler games came up, it was really one of those of, because lots of folks, you know, they didn't have the brain for mechanics or they felt that rules were often an inhibitor to their story. And I disagree with that, but I see their point of view. And, you know, we all play the way we like. But it didn't free them from running into problems when they weren't familiar with, like, how certain archetypes work or how certain stories do and don't fit together. Or they would try to tell particular... stories or ideas, or they would try to mash concepts they had into games that really were not made for them. And I wanted to provide a way of explaining that without it devolving into just play this other game because you don't know what you're doing, because that argument never goes anywhere.
Right. And look, I said it on the show, you know, you said you listened, so you've heard it, but that article you wrote explained so much of the leveling thing that drives me crazy with D&D, and it's because that's not what D&D was meant. D&D isn't meant to do what I was wanting it to do, and so I went and found other games. But you know, like it's like a section of design that just never gets talked about.
And it's because lots of games, you also mentioned this on the show, but for folks who didn't catch that episode, you know, there are lots of games that have a very specific scale, even if they don't tell you that's what it is. It's like a, for example, as I mentioned in the article, I'm like getting into Exalted. It's a friend of mine's favorite game. So I'm like, okay, I will concede that this is a thing you like and give it a look in good faith. And I did. And I was like, oh, this is opera. Okay. And so once I realized, like, oh, we want mythical, we want operatic, we want big and bombastic and ridiculous. I'm like, I can do that. It just would have been helpful to have like a note on the front of it of this is what we want for this. Because there were several other players who were also new to it. And they're like, well, I kind of want to do this like really small, really localized concept. And several of us who had done enough of the reading just kind of gently put a hand on their shoulder of, we appreciate that that's what you would like to do. That will not work here. It is explicitly designed not to function at that level. And if you try, you're going to be frustrated and it's going to spread out and you're going to be very, you know, discouraged. Whereas if you try to take that big, ridiculous, operatic, you know, level of play of, you know, it's like I, you know, was given power by a demon and went to hell and now I'm like overthrowing the world for my cosmic masters. And you try to play that at like a level one evil campaign for D&D or Pathfinder, you're going to get laughed away from the table. And it's just one of those of, you could build up to that, but, you know, it's the question of where do you start, whereas it's usually thought of as power level, but, you know, it's also just story level. Well, and
No, like you're saying, we think of it as power level, but explaining it as scale makes so much more sense. Because
it's,
it's the scale, literally. It's how big are the pieces you're playing with?
Yeah, it's like an example that I had given of, I think I mentioned it as an aside in the post, and you guys brought it up, but it was because I really love Chronicles and World of Darkness games, but it's a thing I've butted heads with a lot of people over of, because they want to do like the big, like global threats or the huge national crises. And, you know, my brain is usually going, it's like, I just want to do like a Sam Spade private detective story where I get to play an ogre. Like, that's the level of threat that I want of. This is very personal to everyone involved and very important to them. But if things go sideways, or even if we win, like, no one outside this neighborhood is going to know or care. And it's that kind of like Chinatown thing of like, yeah, it might be important to the players on the stage, but there's no pressure that if you screw this up, like the whole world ends and the masquerade has been destroyed and I don't know, vampires run for Congress or whatever.
It's Daredevil versus, you know, Captain America.
Absolutely.
You know, I just want to say thank you again for writing that, because it was like, yes, this is the thing that I've been thinking. I just didn't know how to say it.
That's my goal is to give people like the words to think about things that we occasionally have trouble explaining to each other. It's several other issues in the past. One that I still remember, I think it was A Class by Any Other Name Would Smell Just as Sweet, something like that. It was a thing I noticed particularly for Pathfinder and Dungeons and Dragons of, because we have to call our classes something, but so often we default to certain words and certain ideas, and we have associations and archetypes of those in our brains, even if what's actually in the rules doesn't force us to do that. Like the primary example that I had was just people who are like, no, barbarians have to be from the middle of nowhere and they can't read and they speak in third person because they're all stupid. And I just kind of pointed it out in the rule set. It's like, says here from walks civilized or savage. So I was trying to explain to them, no, my character is canonically a prince. I have the background, like his mother is the queen. He's just not useful for anything other than like throwing him in armor and putting him out at the tourney. Like, he's basically a pro wrestler who happens to be rich. And it broke so many people's brains of like, but you can't do that. And it's like, where does it say I can't?
Well, but I think too, you have, and I'm giving away a little bit of my age here, although I haven't played as much as many people my age. That in particular, I think, is a holdover, because if I'm not mistaken, those were the rules in second edition.
Yep, it was second and third, but you know, it's part of it was language, and part of it was occasionally, especially for older players, of they'll remember things from older editions, and then they won't check the newer editions when they start playing them. Like, there were so many people who were like, no, you can't play a lawful rogue. I'm like, why not? Well, because thieves couldn't be lawful. It's like, yes, but we're not playing second ed. And then they would read it and be like, and it was that moment where they either had to concede they didn't read the book before starting, or that they had just kind of glanced over it and let their assumptions take hold.
Yeah, well, but I think, too, in some ways, I don't think they did a great job of explaining that in the game as they could have not. For such a, you know, like it's very clear how much love and change went into priests and paladins in particular for fifth edition. You know, like they got a lot of love. They're really, really versatile classes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like you said, the rogues, barbarians, well, they got a lot of love, but it's not as apparent.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a lot of it is, on the one hand, I wish that we got more of it in our books, particularly for systems that take out a lot of rules, because it's a thing I've said before on various forums, but it's the... Another part of the question is, because there are so many people that are like, ah, fifth edition is too crunchy and there's too many rules, and I'm over here with my, like, 37 Pathfinder first edition books just looking at them, like, first time? And then there's people to the left of me who have, like, GURPS and riffs who are like, oh, you're adorable.
I've got a stack of Palladium behind me this high.
Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, but, you know, when you take out all those rules, like, you should... fill them in with other stuff of here's, you know, here's how you run like this kind of game. Here's how you create this kind of atmosphere. Spycraft was a really great game for that. I don't know of a lot of people who actually picked it up, and it's very close to my heart, and it had a big influence on Army Men. But in the back of it, in the Game Master section, there's like 15, 20 different like little mini chapters for just running different genres. So, you know, if you want to do like modern, like hardcore, like fighting terrorism, globetrotting game, you know, here's some tips for that. If you want to do Hong Kong action theater, like here's what we recommend. If you want to do like military and bio horror, like people have been doing weird experiments in like James Bond style labs, yeah, here's how you do that. And so you get the one game, but it gives you this very versatile resource for playing it in all these different ways without having to change any of the necessary functionality of the thing that you bought, which was really neat, and I wish more people did that.
Yeah, well, I wonder too, though, like you pointed out, and I've been conscious of it, how often do we shoot ourselves in the foot with games because we do play from memory?
Yeah, it happens a lot. I will say that is one of the great things of playing in the digital age, of any time there is a disagreement at the table, we can just whip out our phones and just do a quick search of, oh, never mind, I found the rule, it was updated 3 months ago, my bad. Instead yeah. of how it used to be of where we all have a DMG and we're all trying to find the section.
And then, well, yours is this printing and mine's that printing and blah, blah, blah. And like, I've always kind of had the philosophy that I don't really care what the rule book says. As long as it works for us at this table and we apply it uniformly, who gives a shit?
Yeah, and that is a fine philosophy.
You know, like the one I'll point to, and I don't know, you mentioned Rifts. Actually, that was the first game I ever ran.
Oof, starting on hard mode.
Well, I didn't know I was starting on hard mode. My roommate in college had the books. I'm like, oh, this is a cool world. I want to play this. No one wants to run it. Okay, fine, I'll run it. I had no idea what I was doing whatsoever. So, Rifts, for those who aren't familiar with it, has a stat in it called horror factor, which is basically how disturbing is seeing this being, creature, whatever. Well, because of, and people have heard me make jokes about Palladium's publishing organization of the books, I had never actually found the section that said what you were supposed to do for the horror factor if they failed the save, because there's a save versus horror, right? Okay, so you make a save versus horror. I had somehow just made the jump to the way we played sand checks in the... Now, this was... the original Delta Green as a supplement for 5th edition Call of Cthulhu that we were playing, that was a very bizarre game where we ran into Mulder and Scully and fought Predators and Daleks and many assorted strangenesses. But, you know, with a sand, you freak out. So I just, well, that's the way we're going to run it. And because, inevitably because of how dice behave, you would always have one person at the table who would just continuously fail their horror save.
Yeah, that person is me.
Well, it wasn't always the same person. But so after, you know, we were playing it as you kind of just stand there gibbering. So because you always had this just as a comedy element, we kind of house ruled that if you failed three in a row, you peed your pants and ran away because everyone just thought it was fun. So then the one day I'm flipping through the book, doing something, you know, looking for something for next session, whatever. And I find the section of, well, you, if you fail your horror save, you take a minus this to this and that, minus that to that, and a minus, you know, there's like a quarter chart. Column chart thing. I'm like, oh, so next session we get together. Like, okay, guys, you know, look, I just found the rules for how you're supposed to do horror factor saves. This is how you're supposed to do it. And I read it to him. I said, so would y'all like to do it this way or just keep doing it the way we have? They went, no, let's keep doing it the way we have. It's more fun.
Fair.
You know, so like, but I think some people need to have someone give them permission to do that. And I like the fact that you're not afraid to do that.
Oh yeah. It's a thing I've had to remind folks occasionally, because I've had certain people get very combative when I give advice, and I have to remind them, like, guys, I am a random blog on the internet. I have no ability to change the way you do things at your house. If you don't like my advice, you don't have to use it. Even if I wrote the game, by all means, do it your own way.
Well, right, but see, I think that's the point so many people miss about this hobby. Because I've played with those people who are like, but the book says. I'm like, I don't care what the book says. I mean, within reason, right? There are balanced things designed into games.
Yes, it comes with that caveat of, if you changed it without understanding how it was supposed to function, it creates a cascade of failure that is on you.
Right. But yeah, so like, I don't know. Like I said, I just think that's neat. I don't know where to go next, because we just sort of went down a rabbit hole. But do you want to talk about, I know you have, what, one release already out for Army Men?
Yep.
Supplement. And I know you've talked about, written blog articles about assorted other things. So shall we start there and see where that goes?
Absolutely. For folks who weren't here when we talked about it last time, Army Men, a game of tactical plastic, is a game where you get to play resinous persons who are currently under threat from the Vespoids, of giant insectoid creatures who are attempting to kill you and everyone you love and destroy your country. So this is why you're at war. And it has been a lot of fun, like, going back through it, because there was a good year and change after I handed it off to folks where I just didn't look at it, didn't mess with anything, didn't change anything unless Josh came back in and was like, hey, we were thinking about a change to this. And then I would look up that section and be like, yeah, that's probably a good idea in retrospect. Do that. But, you know, because, you know, a standalone game is great, and, you know, and we all love them, but the supplemental material is necessary if you want to keep folks involved. And I figured, well, let's get it out sooner rather than later. And so the first one we had was Threat Assessments, which is just a whole bunch of new stuff for you to throw your troops at. We got new Vespoids, which are just the generic name of all the weird insectoid monsters. I've included strange machines that no one knows from, because there's always cheap plastic robots in the toy aisle. There was a couple of homages specifically requested by backers, one which was an easy bake oven. And the other of which was creepy crawlers, for those who remember that, make your own weird little bug toy. And I worked in I'm very proud of this one, because I have a very soft spot for very cheesy action movies, as evidenced by this game. But the EBO troops, as they've been referred to as, are kind of my take on the Universal Soldier. Of, you know, it was discovered in a secret lab that if you use this technology, you can essentially create reanimated troops, but there's something wrong with them. And yeah, they could either be allies or monsters, depending on how you want to use them. But you know, there's some cosmic horror, there's some elements that you could go to if you're like, it's like, I like this game and I like how silly it is, but I want to contrast that silliness with something really like horrific and really scary. So we've got, you know, I think spine mites are probably the worst thing I put in there. They're a reference to the novel The Puppet Masters. Of just the alien creatures that would take control of your brain and force you to do things.
The thing I loved about that game is it is just an homage to going to the dollar store, walking down the toy aisle and going, oh, that looks cool. I'm going to use that next week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even if you just got, if you have a bunch of random crap laying around in your house, as I'm sure most of us do, you can just put it on a battle mat and you don't have to paint anything. You don't have to create any weird effects. You know, it's like, no, that's what the battlefield looks like. This is canonical and correct.
Yeah, it's just, and I love the fact that you're going and just going, oh yeah, here's more weird crap and stats for it.
Absolutely. And I was very fortunate that there were a couple other designers that helped with threat assessments, which is how we got it out so quick. The one I'm currently working on is going to come from Ezekiel Games, which is one of the other major I work with, and it's Medals of Honor. It is an optional system you can use, which works kind of like achievement feats in Pathfinder of depending on, and this is, it's a thing I wanted to give game masters the authority, not just to put the system in place, but to make sure that you don't have that thing where your players find the shiny new toy and then they insist it happen in the game and then you're annoyed because you couldn't deny it to them. The way the medal system works is all of them have prerequisites that, you know, troopers have to meet throughout the game. And, you know, sometimes it's you must be part of this country's military. Like, we do not give this to people from other nations. It's our thing. And some of them are like, must defeat this type of enemy this number of times. It's very fetch questy. But it has that thing of, if you as the game master did not set them up to earn these medals, then they can't get them. You know, it's you have to be actively part of the process and part of the discussion, because I like giving people toys, but I wanted to avoid that scenario where you end up with a very player versus GM mentality.
No, that usually doesn't end well.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I try to remind folks, and particularly when playing this game, of game masters have so much control over how challenged their players are, not just by how many monsters they throw at them or where they put the cover or all those things, but because you're part of the armed forces, they have to requisition equipment from you. So it's one of those of, if you want to make this mission extra hard, make them count their bullets and only give them like basic armor and basic weapons. And if you want them to just have like a big old blast of a time, like just throw that out the window. Use the Hollywood guns rule of like your gun only jams when you mess up something horribly and you have as many grenades as you can physically carry. I don't care. Go nuts.
Right. Well, but that's cool. And again, because you gave people permission to do it either way, like some people I think just need to see that permission. And yep. And that's not right, wrong, or indifferent. That's just because people are different.
Yeah, it's one of those of, as you end up with the, I didn't know I could do that. You absolutely can, if that's what you want. You don't have to, but you can.
But I love that look on a player's face when they have that, oh, I can do that realization.
And getting a lot of that with Exalted too.
Well, I'll tell you one. Are you familiar with Grant Howitt's Havoc Brigade?
I have heard it, and I've heard you all talk about it. So I have enough of a general idea to follow about it.
So it's really intended as a one-shot con game of, here, go play orcs, raise hell, and have fun. It's not actually about what you get done. It's about the shenanigans along the way. But I ran this at a convention, and I got fortunate in this case that the crew that signed up for my game was an entire home gaming group.
Ooh, that's always fun.
Like DM and their players. So. And it's not expressly said in Havoc Brigade, but it's meant to be very collaborative and build off this. So at one point, something happened, and I looked at, you know, the player to my left and went, he just jumped into an animal enclosure. What's in it? And I had this, the player space went to like this panic look of, oh my God, what wasn't I paying attention to? I'm like, no. You just get to tell me what's in there.
Yeah.
And this look came over them like, oh, and then I just started, you know, this would happen, you know, like the one item on the one person's character sheet is, you know, 5 magic mushrooms. No one knows what they do. So
uh-oh.
You're like, I'm going to take one. I looked the person across the table. What effect does it have? And so when they started realizing, oh, we can mess with each other. And because they all knew each other, it was just, at some point I got to try and see if I can find the people and see how much it changed. Or if it changed how they play at their home table, you know, like, did it like turn a light bulb on overall, or was it just a fun diversion? And again, not right, wrong, but like that moment of, oh, I can do that is priceless to see on someone's face.
Yeah. I have seen a lot of it recently, as I have recently the storyteller chair, but for a little while I was having some people who were getting used to it. And it was nice to see that enthusiasm of that slow transition from just passively sitting and waiting to be told what happens to realizing like, oh, I have agency. I can do things. Stuff. And I'm like, very well, you took the gamble and you did some stuff. Let's see what happens.
So I guess maybe somewhere we can go from here. You know, Army Men is 5e based, very tactical, you know, as the name implies. You also, you know, you spoke a bunch about Pathfinder. I never actually played Pathfinder itself. I did play a bunch of 3.5, so I'm in the neighborhood, you know. I get the rough concept. But you've also mentioned you play a lot of Storyteller, Story Path, World of Darkness, wherever that whole mishmash lies. And I know my first exposure to that was back with, you know, Vampire the Masquerade when it was all first coming out. And at the time, I didn't realize that is not at all meant to be played the same way you play, you know, Dungeons and Dragons or whatever. And so I'm curious, you know, you obviously have a foot very firmly in the more tactical, stat-based type of games, but also I think World of Darkness was the, not the birth, but the commercial manifestation of narrative, the narrative trend in games. Does that make sense?
That seems fair.
You know, like it was the first big one to go, it's more about the story than what we're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so where do you, like, you know, you clearly have some interest in both. And I don't want, you know, for people that are just listening to this and don't know anything, you know, about your work or whatever, you know, I don't want them to think, oh, he's just a, you know, a Pathfinder guy, whatever. You know what I mean? So, like, how do you balance them? Or do you have, like, different segments of your brain that, oh, I'm playing this kind of game, playing that kind of game?
Yeah, it's a very similar theory that I have for both of them, actually. It's just the results tend to be different. When I sit down to make something, I ask myself, what is whoever my imaginary target is who may look like me, what are they most likely to actually use? Not just like, ooh, this was neat, and then never look at it again, of what's going to show up on the table, what's going to become a group favorite, or a thing the storyteller hates but can't prevent you from using because they said yes, you can have it. And for game masters and storytellers, of it's what are the things that always trip you up and that suck out all that creative juice, so that when you have to come up with something big or you have to come up with something elaborate, you're just, you know, there with an empty tank of like, I've already invented like 3 bars and 2 stores and half a dozen NPCs. I don't have time to actually describe like the Legion of Doom you now have to deal with this evening. And so lots of the stuff that I'll put out there is just meant to fill in those blank spaces for both players and storytellers. I think one of the most popular things I've done for the Chronicles and World of Darkness, only Chronicles, because Changeling the Lost and Changeling the Dreaming are not compatible. But because I love Changeling the Lost, it's Call of Cthulhu, but you get powers without going immediately crazy. The crazy happens later. But because they have, it's a thing in World and Chronicles of Darkness games of you have your different types of the monster that you are, you have the political organization to which you belong, and you have your special pocket universe that only people like you can access. These are some of the universal traits of all these games, because it worked really well for the first one, so why not keep it going? And you know, in Changeling, for those not familiar, you have the Hedge, which is this big, huge dimension of just Alice in Wonderland-level nonsense where anything could theoretically manifest, and that is something that occasionally leads to just decision paralysis among storytellers and players, and they just end up defaulting to, I don't know, magic fairy forest and stuff, and it's weird. And they'll just kind of chaperone you to the place they actually want to go, and what I like doing for that is, here's a bunch of stuff you can just have happen in it, whether it's like bizarre creatures you run into or strange fruits you find growing and what their effects on you can be. Here's some just encounters you can have with stuff you might meet there. And some of it you can use to build a whole narrative out of that. At one point in time, there was a fire-breathing penguin in a Hawaiian shirt just kind of waddling along the path that I put in one of them, who ended up becoming a secret trufee in the game I was running, because everyone just reacted so positively to him. I'm like, no, he's staying around. It's an NPC now. But yeah, that's what I try to do for storytellers, of because I know so often folks who want to run more narrative games will have an idea of what they want the plot or the feeling or the atmosphere to be, but they'll trip up on all the little things, all the little details that there's always that moment when the player goes, like, who's the guy at the bar? It's like, crap. And then you have to make it up on the side. It's, I don't know, it's just some guy named Jeff. I want to go talk to Jeff. So you're here to discuss important matters with, like, you know, the Primogen. Yeah, yeah, he'll wait. Yeah, it's like I found those are the things people tend to like most, and so that's what I tend to focus on. But I would like to do some other just bigger world building constructs of, you know, create some of just the city books of just here's some stuff you'll find in any given major city. It's one of the things I love so much about that setting is it's one of the ones that does the hidden world best in quotes, and I find that really engaging. But I also can get very overwhelming, so that's sort of what I want to do is provide people the tools they can use to tell the story without having people stop every five or six steps to point at a thing and ask, like, why this is still loading.
Okay. I was gonna say, I did notice clicking through, you know, click your name on drive-through and the just pages of 100 whatever. I think Azakhail does a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are just such a great resource, because I'm not going to say everyone thinks this way, but you give me one of those books and I go, oh, I can have this and then I'll do this with it. And it's a prompt. It's not, I'm not using it for the thing that it is. It's a prompt to last episode, Steve talked about using things as diving boards. And that's what I find those books for me are so good for. Is it's a diving board. It's this nugget that I wouldn't have thought of, but I can take it and run with it.
Well, absolutely. And it is my hope that people do that. And some of them have uses both for storytellers and for players, whether you're, because I know, like, a lot of players, particularly if you're newer to this setup in this world, it's very easy to get overwhelmed by stuff, to get just paralyzed and wait for someone to tell you what the quote unquote best option is when there usually isn't one. Like, the first project I actually did with Josh, I did 100 kinfolk for each of the werewolf tribes of Werewolf the Apocalypse, because that was the version I knew best, and I had to do the least amount of research. And it was one of those things of, if you're a storyteller, you can use these as just helpful NPCs, as they're kind of meant to be in the lore of, like, oh no, a thing went wrong, like, call my second cousin twice removed who's in the sheriff's department, he'll clear this up for us, and we don't have to worry about it. But you could also have that thing of, like, one of your players wants to take allies or wants to take contacts or whatever, and then they have that thing, they want to use this thing on their sheet of, like, well, like, who do I get in touch with? You can just look down the list and go, okay, which of the NPCs here are going to have that information? Or if you have a player who, like, I want to play this tribe, but I have no idea what I want to do. It's like, okay, like, look down the list. Do any of these sound like a background or a character concept or a story that you think would be neat? And then just, like, you can just go, okay, you were born a kinfolk. You have had your first change. Congratulations. Here's a one-paragraph description of your new character. Run with it.
So it sounds like what you've kind of been doing a lot of is doing a lot of that generic prep that as game masters, most of us hate.
Yep.
Because it's the exact stuff that Steve and I have talked about on numerous episodes, where if you, because prep is, it's such a weird thing, right? Like, you don't want to do too much, because as anyone who's GM'd more than a few sessions knows, if you think they'll go A, B, C, or D, they're on
not
like
happening.
J and W, and you're like, I didn't even conceptually think they might do something like that. What the hell do I do now? And I think it's cool to have some, because I think that too is, or let me just ask, you know, you've talked with a lot of people on this type of thing, I'm sure. Is that one of the big hurdles people run into trying to do more narrative games is, but what do I do when they don't do the thing I expected? Whereas if you're doing a dungeon crawl, okay, they didn't go to the rooms in order, but we can make that work.
It is a thing that I've run into a lot for folks who enjoy more narrative stories, whether you're doing mystery solving or whether you're doing, yes, tense peace agreements between different supernatural factions, whatever your particular flavor happens to be. But they'll have, like, the handful of characters that are like, these are the important NPCs and I really like them and they're going to be important because they run things. We can't ignore them. You know, we don't have to like them, but we can't ignore them. And they'll have, you know, here's a handful of cool set pieces I've designed and I think these are fun. And when players either go outside of those areas or they want to interact with other people, things get very generic very quickly. And, you know, it's like sometimes you'll get that lucky moment as a as a GM or a storyteller, where you'll just like come up with like your Barnaby, who happens to be just the ancient ghoul butler that everyone's like, no, he's ours now. If you hurt him, we burn the city to the ground. But a lot of the time you just wind up with like, ah, it's Officer Smith. I don't know. And then he just tells you to move on because I don't care about this part of the plot. And there is a lot of it is just because there's so much going on in these worlds at any given time. But a lot of it is also, as storytellers, you only have so much energy, and having resources that are flexible can be very helpful, even if you use them in unexpected ways or in unexpected games, which can sometimes mess with people. If you just like have a bunch of like, you know, NPCs meant for werewolf, but you're running a vampire game, you can then use it in an unexpected way of like, okay, you all went into the city and you messed about in the wrong section. Who saw you? And then you just go down the list of that guy, you know, who's he reporting it to? I don't know. This guy. Hey, I built a whole new plot. Cool.
Right. But I think the other thing that using resources like these ones you're talking about also eliminates that, I don't know what you want to call it, almost that feeling that we get a lot of times as GMs where I spent all this time making this stuff and I didn't use it. And that can be very disheartening. And fortunately, there are people like you who will make all this stuff and then we don't have to. And it like solves a lot of problems at once, even though, yeah, I think you have to recognize as a GM that best laid plans don't mean crap once you get the players involved.
Yeah, absolutely. It is one thing, speaking of that design philosophy, it played a lot into what I did with my Sundara Dawn of a New Age setting. It's why I released Cities, and I gave you just enough information. Like, you know, here's the general culture of the city. Here's some cool stuff about it. Here's a map. Here's some notable NPCs for each district. Here's a couple of plot hooks if you want to use them. It's like all of that empty space between those lines I gave you, do whatever you want with it. And my hope was that folks would look at these places and be like, ooh, that's evocative, that's neat. And then they'll have whatever the plot is going on in the back of their head of like, I want to run a plot where someone steals a dragon's egg and you have to like hunt them down and bring the egg back to the dragon so it just doesn't go berserk and start this like entire like crusade. And it's like, cool, here's a city called Horde Reach, City of Worms. It's run by 5 dragons. Now they have not only pissed off one dragon, but the entire like collective that runs this city full of monsters. You have a ticking time clock before Horde Reach goes to war. Find that egg.
Right. But it sounds like, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, you've almost taken a philosophy similar to, I think, what was done by Keith Baker and the team that initially created Eberron, where they kind of set up this world and went, this is how it is. There's some stuff that's detailed enough to be interesting. There's some stuff that's vague for you to do your own thing with. And the thing I love about that setting is they've intentionally kept the timeline static. Mm-hmm. It doesn't advance. It's like, here is a world, have fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in listening to anything, you know, Keith does, be it in his writings or, you know, podcasting, whatever, he was in my Eberron. And he's not saying that in, well, I created it, it's mine. It's in the game that I run, this is how it is. Your Eberron can be whatever you want it to be, but it's very intimidating for a lot of people, I think, if you don't have a picture to start from. And it sounds like that's with this, was it Sundara?
Yes.
That's kind of what you were going for, is here's a picture to start with. Do what you want with it in a way. Am I reading that wrong or?
Oh no, that's very accurate. This actually gets back to concepts of scale and things we all want out of games. Of there are several folks that I've played with, and like that is the thing they love best. Of they love being able to affect the setting they're playing in big important ways, not necessarily just the ones that are scripted. So like as an example, if you'll have a game set in Galarian, you know, Pathfinder's standard setting, and like the whole thing is like, ah, we're gonna leave this evil queen and we're gonna do something with their country, there's at least one person I play with who will go like, yeah, that's cool, I want the throne. It's like, this is what? Yeah, this is gonna be my country when we're done, and I'm gonna institute all these new laws and we're gonna do things in my image. And it's that whole thing of like, that's not what's written into the adventure path, but I'm not telling you no. Whereas, you know, a lot of the time I'll have things where it's like, no, I want the broad map I'm looking at to remain mostly the same. but I want the things that my character has changed to be on like a district by district level of, you know, if I ever achieve that level of power, it should be by total accident. But yeah, then again, that comes to, you know, you can take the same setting and the same tools and the same setup and have both of those games, maybe not necessarily the same players in the same game, but that's a completely different issue.
Well, but that goes, like you were talking about, scale. Scale defines, or you can play in the same setting at a different scale.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a thing I tried to do at least a couple of times when just putting out hooks for my own world. Of some of these are like, these are things I am assuming you have a low level group of people who don't have access to a lot of resources, and this will be a challenge for them. And others where it's like, you could get away with this if you're low level and you're very smart. This is probably geared more toward people who have, you know, more resources and are more organically tied into the power structures of this city, whether that's because you've been running a game for a long time, you're starting at level 5 or 6, whatever it happens to be. And yet this is one of those of, I do not present them with any labels, I do not present them with any, like, order you have to do them in, or if you do them at all. These are just like, you know, here's some things to get the pump in your brain going, and let's see what you come up with.
So, now this setting of yours, is this... Are you releasing it for Pathfinder, PF2, 5E? Are you releasing it more as system agnostic, all of the above?
Yeah, for, let's see, the first book for Sundara, it's released entirely in supplements. There's no, like, big main core book for it, because I'm one person and I can only... But it came out about 3 years ago. It was Iron Fire, the City of Steel, which has an amazing piece of art that we managed to get a hold of because Sin Nomine, like, had a big art pack full of great art that they just made free to all creators. And we all saw that and went, great, and we put it on our games. And now we just get endless questions asking whether or not this is a Godbound supplement. But I originally released it for Pathfinder's first edition because that's the one I knew best. And it was still kind of in that area of, we all acknowledge this is on the way out for company support, but how many of us want to keep playing in it? And then I did D&D 5e ports because at the time, you know, it was one of those like D&D 5e or nothing. There's no other. And there are a couple of them that are system agnostic just because there's no real mechanics in them. It's just like, here's a bunch of cool stuff. The most recent one I did was Merchants of Sundara, which is just 10 big merchant houses or people who provide certain services or certain items. And there's just, here, cool stuff to fill in the blanks. Use it in whatever fantasy way you want. But, you know, others, I have, like, Sellswords of Sundara is a collection of either archetypes or subclasses for being part of 10 of the most infamous or famous, depending on your viewpoint, mercenary companies throughout the setting. So it's not just, hey, the Risen Legion, who kind of declared a war crime because they have just industrial necromancy they use on the battlefield. If you want to be a part of that, here's a thing you could do for it. If you don't want to, there's 9 other companies you could join, or you could just... keep whatever, like, subclass class you want and just be a part of the organization. It's not required you take this. It's just a neat little way to organically tie yourself to stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious because for whatever reason, I have Green Ronin's Fantasy Age on the brain lately. I actually want to do something set in... Did you ever watch Into the Badlands?
Yes, I love that show.
I so badly want to play something in that setting, and I've been trying to find a system that can do it. And I think the stunt system from Age may pull it off.
That sounds like it would work. Like, my only other suggestion would be Feng Shui, but that is a very rules-light game, and that may not satisfy everybody. For folks looking for it, check it out. It's
Yeah, I almost got to play that in October. I was kind of disappointed because it was at a convention and not enough people showed up to do anything. So it was But I got to play Savage Worlds, so that was good.
That's good, then.
But yeah, I felt like the flexibility of that stunt system may, because for people who haven't seen that show, it is a strangely cohesive, bizarre mashup.
Yes, let's see, it was a post-apocalyptic, epic martial arts drama?
With
weird future sci-fi nonsense?
I told someone last night, we're like, it's Mad Max meets Gone with the Wind with...
Meets Iron a Korean Fist. Opera.
Like it's a really entertaining watch. I didn't actually get finished with it, and now it's not on Netflix anymore, and I'm very annoyed.
Yeah, and no one else has even tried anything like it.
Yeah, but I saw it when I first saw it. I'm like, oh, I want to play a game in this world.
Yes, it is. It is a very RPGable setting, if the term.
Yeah. Now, then you get into licensing, and Lord knows that's a kettle of fish. That, well, I don't know. Have you had to deal with any licensed properties effectively?
Yes, I have not, because you know, that is the one thing I will tell people of. Despite my name being on all this stuff, I do not do any self-publishing. I am willing to just take a royalty cut and let other people deal with that headache. But I mostly work with community content platforms who give you the thing of, here's the rules, create stuff within this barrier. And I'm like, I can do that. I know that a couple of the companies I've worked with, like Azekiel Games is one of the many, many folks out there who've done the licensing for Call of Cthulhu stuff, so I have a couple supplements I've written for that setting, mostly historical stuff, because occasionally I like to scratch that itch. But, like, I've had a couple of scenarios where it's like, hey, we could do a thing, we'll get a license for this, and I'm like, that sounds complicated and like it would involve lawyers. If someone else contracts me, I'm there for it, but I'm going through the headache for that.
Well, and then you have to deal with, you know, we want to give someone else the license. You're out of luck.
Yes. Isn't that how we got deities and demigods?
Well, like I got them on the Humble Bundle that I think they got put on out of spite. EN Publishing's Judge Dredd RPG. The license got pulled.
So I hadn't heard about that.
Oh yeah. This was like a year ago. They basically pulled the license out from under him. I don't know if there was a contract expiring that didn't get renewed. You know, I don't know any details other than suddenly now the new official Judge Dredd RPG uses the Dredd RPG rules, which I don't know how that works for that. Like, I'm not saying anything about the game at Dredd, but I don't know how that works for that world.
Is it, my response is Dredd face, just.
But, you know, like, so like, yeah. They put them on Humble Bundle for like $25 for everything they'd published for it.
I approve of spite measures. That is great.
Like I said, whether that's, you know, that's my headcanon of the situation, whether it bears anything to reality or not, I don't know. But that can be a lot of headaches. All right. So I guess unless you have anything other in specific you want to ramble on about, do you want to take a minute to talk about all the various places your work can be found, because I know you do several different blogs and write for lots of things.
Absolutely. Yeah, for folks who are interested in finding me, you can go to my gaming blog, Improved Initiative, which is taking10.blogspot.com. You can find me on the Azekiel Games YouTube channel. I'm there who make a ridiculous amount of content if you miss my voice. You can find me on DriveThruRPG. Just type in my name, Neil Litherland. You'll get about 180 some odd products. And there's a new video. I just actually shot it this morning. I am hoping it should be up on the Azekiel Games channel by Friday. I am hoping to get some community input on where folks want me to go with Sundara as a setting from here, whether they want me to port new editions, or they want to see more of a certain type of content, or you just want more audio dramas, more fiction, whatever it is you want. Chance to raise your voice so that, you know, both my publisher and I can hear it and what you want.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, and we'll put links to all that stuff in the show notes so people can find it easy. I think with that, it's time to play Game of the Week.
Game of the Week. Game of the Week.
You were here before, so you know the rules, or lack thereof. Would you like to go first, or would you like me to?
You go first, just because I'm having a brain fart.
All right. So my game of the week this week, and this is one I'm going to preface this by saying, I found the listing on DriveThru. It sounds very interesting. I do acknowledge, though, that this treads into touchy areas and subject matter. So I have no knowledge of how well any of this is handled. But the concept of the game sounds very interesting to me. So this is a game, and I'll throw a link in our Green Room channel so you can check it out. This is a game called Crossbones Opera, The Golden Age of Reckoning. The premise of this game, it is set in an alternate history where Napoleon conquered and united Europe into a single empire. That empire then started unleashing plagues and disease to decimate indigenous populations, to then plunder treasures, etc. The characters in this game are pirates coming from these remaining indigenous peoples escaped enslaved people, synthetic Europeans, whatever. And their mission is to fight against the colonization and aid people seeking freedom and provide, you know, support, etc. Like I said, this is touching into, for some people, can be trigger-heavy topics. I acknowledge that. Based on the language they're using in the description, it sounds like they've at least attempted to handle it well. But this kind of alt-history pirate, and frankly, in some limited research I've done about the real golden age of piracy, it was actually largely built on disrupting the slave trade as it was. You know, so yes, this is fictional, but there's some nuggets of reality hidden in it. So like I said, that it's, I mean, the core book will set you back $5. There's a bundle with several supplements for like $20. But yeah, it's called Crossbones Opera. And it, like I said, it sounds very interesting. Like I said, I make no claims to knowing how things were handled, but I think it could be an interesting read at the minimum.
That sounds fair. Yes, in the keeping in the tradition of things that come with trigger warnings for those who don't want to see certain topics discussed, of and a game that's not out of circulation, but certainly the least popular variant of the one that's been produced. Of as mentioned earlier, I've just been just chewing my way through Exalted Second Edition, which is generally acknowledged as one of the wonkier and crunchier ones. Yes, to the point that there's an entire extra book just full of stuff they changed to make it more playable. But for those not familiar, of you are in creation that was once made by the ancient primordials until they were, their own creations rose up against them, locked them in hell, and bring half of them. And ideally, the new rulers, which were the children of the unconquered sun, would have continued ruling, but madness has taken them, the world is falling apart, and everything is becoming grimmer and darker by the day. And you've now been invested with that power. The question is, what are you going to do with it? And for folks who have a similar taste and who don't mind very dark themes, I highly recommend checking out the Infernals book, because it speaks to the craving for a very grim, dark, and horrible narrative that I have been looking to tell for a while, and I'm going to be getting to do it.
That's also, the edition has the spaceship that is also a god, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it?
That sounds right. it's very wonky.
We have another podcast on the network that is dedicated to Exalted. And it's called The Wondrous Atlas of Creation's Destiny. And what they do actually is they'll talk about a specific component of the lore, whatever. And most of the time, I haven't listened to it too much because I haven't fallen off that diving board yet. But they will discuss it in the context of both second edition and third edition, how they differ, how you could use it in your games, you know. But we had them on a while ago, and the one host kept going, and there's a spaceship that's also a god.
Yeah, and that's like the least ridiculous thing about it.
So Exalted 2 EA.
It is one thing I'm trying to do very purposefully, because there are the three editions and I'm trying to keep my headspace only in the one, because I know there were changes and I don't want to be that player who shows up full of confidence that I know what's going on and get the wrong edition.
Hey, we could go down the edition wars debate too, but maybe another time.
That's fair.
Because, well, that's an argument that never ends.
Indeed. Could probably just do an entire podcast just on Edition Wars.
Probably could.
Be like Death Battle, but for RPGs.
Two editions enter, one edition leaves.
Yes.
Except for the people who keep it anyway.
Well, that's fair.
All right. Well, I want to say thank you very much for coming on and having this ramble about assorted things. Not all that focused, but that's okay. It was a fun conversation, or at least I thought so.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it quite deeply. I don't usually get to dive down rabbit hole when it's just me talking to the camera.
Well, but that's kind of what we do, right? We kind of pitch the show as those conversations you have sitting around after a gaming session.
Yes. Oh, I miss when we had all-night diners to go to.
Yeah, right? Well, the show started because Steve and I used to stand in our friend's apartment complex parking lot and talk for 3 hours after we played. And then we realized, hey, we live in the southwestern Pennsylvania. It gets cold in the winter. Let's not do this outside anymore.
Great.
So anything else you want to shout out before we sign off?
I'm sure that most people listening are well aware of it, but Owen Casey Stevens currently has his GoFundMe to help with his cancer treatment, and that is a thing I want to let everyone out there know. If you are somehow fucking didn't hear about it, go help, because it's an astonishing number we need to reach, but I'm confident we can do it.
And having had Owen on the show, just a genuinely good human being, and I don't think I've ever heard anyone say anything less than wonderful about Owen. He's just a genuinely nice person. And so, yeah, if you can help him out, you know, by all means, go check that out. I'll find a link for that and put it in the show notes as well, just because. So, yeah, I guess, again, like I said, thank you for coming and chatting. Remind everyone else, all our contact information, links to our Patreon, Discord, et cetera, it's down in the show notes. You know, come chat with us on the Discord. Neil shows up and posts blog links, and Lord knows, maybe someone will ask him a question and he'll jump into a conversation that'll end up today. We were talking about how the Lion King and Star Wars are the same.
Yes, absolutely. Tag me anywhere in the Discord. I will respond when I see it.
So, yeah, you know, come join us there. You know, like, leave us reviews on whatever your podcatcher of choice is, whatever. Go check out, you know, some of Neil's videos with the Azekiel Games people or wherever else you can find him. And I guess with all that, you know, just want to remind everybody to be kind to each other and get out there and go play some RPGs.
Intro and outro music by the band 12 Noon. You can email us at meandsteverpg@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at andrpgs. Find us on Facebook at meandsteverpgpodcast. On Discord at meandsteverpgs. And as always, all of these links are in the show notes. Thank you, and be kind to one another.
How much for the cigar?
Cigar, $20, dog. You gotta go down the street to the store and buy that.